Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. Thanks for joining us. And Fred and I were just talking about GM's most recent announcement. They're going to start the mass production of truly autonomous vehicles, making them the first ones to do it.
So, I mean, I didn't know, even know GM was working on this. When I saw that announcement, I had to back up a little bit. I know that they tried to do an electric vehicle, EV1, I think they called it. And that was almost 20 years ago. And then they backed away from that. Had they been working on? I've only heard of like Tesla and Waymo. You know, I know there's other companies, but I didn't know GM was in this game.
Yeah, they've been working on it. And most big car manufacturers have been working on it. I think that some companies, Tesla is a case in point of how that they're very good at marketing their product and what they do is very visible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the other big auto manufacturers have really been working in this space, and some staff changes have been made because of perceived lack of progress in some big car manufacturers in this space. So that's something that organizationally they're taking very seriously.
Well, given their announcement, though, that they're going to go to mass production, that gives me the impression that they're going to be doing tens of thousands of these vehicles. I mean, does that mean that? But I didn't get the impression, like Tesla with their Model 3s, that you could go pre-order one. I didn't get the impression that my neighbor's going to have an autonomous vehicle anytime soon.
Yeah, the initial plan, as far as I understand it, is that these vehicles will be used in a ride-sharing service, and that anyone who wishes to purchase it will have to wait until that phase of this technological rollout has finished. So the first step certainly doesn't involve customers owning the vehicles, but it certainly will use customers being transported by the vehicles.
All right, when you say a ride-hailing company, I remember when I did some consulting work for a while up on the Microsoft campus in Redmond, Washington, and they are scattered all over that town. They have building at that time, they had buildings, I think 50 or 60 different buildings all over the place and beyond walking distance by easily. And they had a whole fleet of these little cars that were, I think, using a similar tracking system that a taxi would use, right? So they had GPS yep. coordinates, and you'd go to the lobby and say, hey, we need a car to go to building 86. And mm-hmm. 2 minutes later, a car would pull up that was either already waiting out front or in the building next door or whatever. They kind of coordinated it that way. I imagine that kind of technology and that kind of service would be add another seat to the car and get rid of the driver.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
and it's in a very limited, constrained area that it would service.
Well, General Motors' plan is to – we're talking about ride-hailing services, but it's going to be across a number of cities. So one would think it has to be a little bit more sophisticated than that. Mm-hmm. Details haven't really emerged. And I suppose one risk for General Motors is that ride-hailing is not a simple process to manage, and the organizations like Uber and Lyft certainly have a head start, and no doubt they'll be partnering with at least one of those organizations to leverage what they can. So some of the details, if they've emerged yet, I haven't seen it happen. But mm-hmm. It will be interesting. I think it's going to be a very Uber-like service.
Okay. Well, Uber and Lyft and other ride-hailing companies kind of pushed the government agencies in Europe, I think Paris was basically suing them because of I don't know, they weren't spending enough money on taxes, I guess, or something. I don't know. I didn't know the details of it. But that change in the way you request a ride from somebody else that has a vehicle available for hire, that taxi service thing's been around for about 100 years, hasn't it? Or even longer with the horse and buggy type services.
That's true.
Whereas this change in technology allowed, it's like Airbnb and some of the other things that have disrupted various markets. Is that what we're seeing, is that the autonomous vehicle is just pushing the boundary just a little bit further out?
You know, I think so. I think it's going to be pushing the – I mean, there was once a time where you'd have a service that a taxi would provide, and I suppose you consider your own personal motor vehicle, and it provides a service. And those two services didn't really cross over, at least traditionally. You use a taxi when you're on holidays more often than not.
Or but, a business trip for a variety of reasons you use that versus your own vehicle, yeah.
But it's not so much just that these new autonomous ride-hailing services will start replacing the traditional taxi service. They'll also start pushing into the personal motor vehicle service, as in very few people ever stopped having their own personal motor vehicle because of taxis. But we're going to see a lot more of that start to happen, and that will almost certainly require the way ride hailing companies operate now to change in more flexible ways, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of, if I remember the suits, various municipalities and countries have filed against ride hailing guys, it was how they dealt with their drivers. Were they employees or not? And the associated taxes with an employee. Now you take the driver out. There's one part is, well, how do you regulate, do you even want to regulate autonomous vehicles? They are on the roads. They are next to us on the roads. They've got to follow traffic rules and all that other stuff. You know, if an autonomous vehicle from GM, and it comes out of the factory and runs a red light on its first day, who do you write the ticket to? Right?
Well, I think there's two parts to what you're saying. I think a lot of local and state government agencies had almost a symbiotic relationship with the traditional taxi industries, and in many places this symbiotic relationship ended up not being healthy. So you had taxi drivers who needed to pay tens of thousands of dollars in terms of licensing fees, special permits and certificates, which became a very important revenue stream for that jurisdiction. And when you have the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world come in, that revenue stream started to disappear. And there's plenty of government agencies and governments themselves who resisted that under the guise of safety, but it was clear that it was largely a fiscal decision as well. Mm-hmm. It's no secret that those cities and countries which didn't have as big a reliance on the licensing fees associated with traditional taxis were less reluctant to encourage ride hailing. So that's the first part. There's a lot of, you need to look beneath the surface. A lot of
yeah, claims follow the money.
That's right.
Just follow the money. Yeah.
And a lot of it is, and the public hasn't really cared, because once they started using Uber, you could actually work out who was going to be driving. You could actually work out the license plate number and the driver's license number of the person who's going to come and pick you up in a way that you couldn't for the taxi industry. So the public is not really listening to the conversation about safety, and in the way that people was trying to put this safety case forward in the first place. That's from the perspective of the driver,
right?
And they have star ratings. You just don't have that for taxi drivers. And then all of a sudden, you see the service increase, and it's starting to become a moot point,
right? Well, there's the other part, though. The realm of municipalities and legislators and stuff looking at safety aspects of it. They've known autonomous vehicles were going to be hitting the streets for a decade or more. And in some areas, I think San Francisco is welcoming autonomous vehicles for test drives and as a place for them to practice, essentially. They don't seem too terribly concerned that a car's not going to stop for a red light.
No, and I think I think there's some comfort you get when you have if an autonomous vehicle doesn't stop for a red light, that's a technical problem versus a criminal problem. That's not the car's not going to decide to drive through a red light. Mm-hmm. And I think once you scratch past the surface, once we work out, start improving the situations, improving the autonomous vehicle's ability to work out whether the right light is red or not, it's always going to stop. Whereas a human driver isn't always going to stop. The main issue with the laws as it stands is that you usually need to write a ticket to a human being.
Right.
Whereas once an autonomous vehicle is caught driving through a red light, it's not an intent to drive through the red light per se. It's a technical flaw with something or other. It could be a technical flaw with the red light itself. So it needs a different approach.
Well, are they going to? I'm struggling here because one part is that I'm imagining a comedy routine where there's an autonomous car and there's no steering wheel in it and they get pulled over, right?
The
car responds to flashing lights and pulls over and stops, and he comes up and everybody's inside going, "Hey, not our fault, man.
Yeah,
we're just riding. We got our seatbelts on. We're good." You know, but it's also, I'm thinking of also of the, what I don't see is a bunch of regulatory stuff saying, oh, you have to have the red flag guy walk in front of your car, like with the original internal combustion cars or steam-powered cars, right?
Well, I mean, people talk about this because they're still struggling to understand that this is going to be a brand new vehicle. So, for example, take what you just spoke about in terms of a police car, a policeman or police officer pulling over a vehicle. If that police, let's just say all autonomous vehicles have some sort of marking on it and it's clear that that's an autonomous vehicle, The police officer, he's not going to pull over that vehicle in the same way that he currently pulls vehicles across the road because he's not pulling the vehicle across, he's pulling the driver across. Right. So if he observes an autonomous vehicle doing something incorrect, there's going to be a completely different protocol. It might be just that he writes down or observes the license plate number and then files a technical issue report or whatever it is that goes through and then gets automatically fed to the email inbox of that organization which says, hey, your vehicle crossed the line. Here's video of your vehicle crossing lane marker inappropriately or whatever the issue is. You're not going to pull the car over.
If that would be tough, if you see a vehicle, you know, run one red light after another red light, did somebody hack into it? Is it a modified autonomous vehicle?
Yeah.
You know, right? And if it still responds to being pulled over, you remove a hazard from the road. The equivalent of a drunk driver, but in an autonomous vehicle, it's a drunk software algorithm. Or misfiring algorithm or something
That's
right. I imagine that there's going to be a transponder on it that identifies the vehicle and says, hey, you know, don't overwrite the black box recorder kind of thing. Or then it gets all into the privacy types issues and everything else. But it also brings up just the liability part, right? If we can't write a ticket to a driver for their lack of attention or their breaking of a traffic law, or if they get in an accident, there's insurance industry set up to deal with that, right? The owner's different though. If it's a ride-hailing company owns a fleet of self-driving cars.
Yeah, and that's going to be a change that I think people are a lot more afraid of than they need to be. I mean, quite simply, the customer's not going to stand for any situation where they're liable for an autonomous vehicle deciding to turn into a parked car, for example. It's just that's just not going to happen. And Volvo CEO in particular has been leading the charge in proclaiming that, no, his organization will be liable for all accidents that occurred. And that's quietly acknowledged by most auto manufacturers who are working in this space. So the liability will remain will almost certainly remain with the manufacturer. And that's a good thing because regardless of whatever we think right now, we pay for liability when we get our own insurances.
Right.
Someone's paying for it. And if you have the manufacturer who's manufacturer liable, it's a great behavioral modifier. If they can make their car safer, they incur fewer costs in terms of liability and damages payouts throughout the year. And all of a sudden we have a really positive motivation that previously didn't exist.
Right. And it takes, well, the technology itself takes that driver out. The programmers and the sensors and all of those aspects still remain, yet that's all under the purview of that manufacturer.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I think it's going to blur. I'm remembering a discussion we had at RAMS in January where it was, oh, some lawyer is going to get a hold of this and really go after him. And I think the point you made, Chris, was I've been saying it over and over again anytime this conversation's come up, is like, look, an autonomous vehicle just has to make as good as or better decisions than a human, which is already pretty bad.
That's right.
You know, it's, the standard isn't that they can never have an accident. Accidents will happen. And it's this that the standard is the human population. It doesn't have to be 10x better. Yet I remember that the table, and it was almost split by the old time engineers from Detroit versus us Californians, that saw this in a different way, is that we were like, no, it already is proving to be better, and it has the capability to become much, much better. And I think what you mentioned about the liability being offered, or the assurance essentially being carried by the manufacturers, it reinforces that process that they want it to get better. But it's there's only so much training you can do with a human driver. Now, some of the best roads and best driving I've ever done, and the safest I ever felt on roads, was in Germany. But the driver's training there is pretty rigorous. It's grueling. Mm-hmm. And I think it took a diplomatic feat for the Germans to allow American soldiers to drive on their roads, which I don't blame them. It was remarkable. And then coming back to the States, it's shocking how, and then other parts of the world are even worse, or different, I should say. Whereas if a car learns something in San Francisco and that gets pushed out into the code update, all of a sudden, all cars are driving better. And I think there's some huge advantages to that in the long term of these things.
And that conversation you were talking about was, again, people are struggling to move to a new paradigm. The premise of that discussion was, where do lawyers come into play? They come into play when there's ambiguity. Mm-hmm. So the current approach to liability, does the vehicle meet the standards, or does the vehicle meet the intent of the standards? If yes, then it has some limitations on liability. If no, then the manufacturer is liable. There have been plenty of cases argued in court where drivers have argued no, that didn't meet the standard. Yes, it did. Then you have the fact that the vehicle needs to be maintained in a roadworthy state. Was a driver at fault? So on and so forth.
Right,
and that's where lawyers become relevant, because they try and argue the case. But the point was that if there's no ambiguity, if there's a single organization responsible for or liable for these things, which would have to be the case, you would think, then lawyers are going to be made largely redundant, because it's always going to revert back to the manufacturer. And no doubt.
You heard it here first. The lawyers are going to be a thing of the past.
Well, some would argue lawyers are redundant right now. So
there's that.
but there's going to be no argument over whether it was a driver at fault with autonomous vehicles, which are especially those providing a service. It's not up to the consumer to maintain them. So again, it's a ride sharing service which needs to be responsible for maintenance, and that ride sharing service needs to operate in lockstep with the autonomous vehicle manufacturer, if indeed it's a separate organization. So all of a sudden, all the ambiguity associated with who was at fault, it's not going to be the consumer anymore. The consumer is not going to be responsible for driving the car. The consumer is not going to be responsible for maintaining the car, at least at the same level. And it was, and at the end of the day, that conversation, we said, hey, don't forget, someone will be liable. No one's arguing there's no liability. There will be someone liable. So liability won't just disappear. It's just going to be made a lot clearer. And that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Yeah. I remember one of the questions I think we used to wrap it up, basically, that it was a dinner. We had, what, 6 or 7 people at the table. And mm-hmm. I asked, so who would get in an autonomous vehicle today if your ride-hailing company delivered you a car with no steering wheel in it? Would you get in? And it was split.
Yeah.
You know, and the reasons behind it was, well, I don't trust it. And that brings up a bigger question, though, and it's not just with autonomous vehicles. It's with any technology. I remember cell phones. When they first came out, people were afraid of them because of the radio waves going through your head. Mm-hmm. If only you could see how many radio waves are going through your brain right now.
Yes, right.
you won't be worried about adding a phone next to your head. Is some of this just ignorance? Some of it just familiarity? I think earlier today you mentioned this phase of the rollout of this technology. Is this part of an algorithm to gain market acceptance?
I also throw in microwaves as the microwave oven as another example of, you know, people were scared that, you know, the same similar reason to the smartphones. Mm-hmm. I just think that if you look at history in terms of emerging technologies and emerging practices, including medicine, there's always been healthy skepticism, or perhaps unhealthy skepticism for something.
Well, there's a whole spectrum of that. I think it's a whole spectrum from healthy to unhealthy, and it's where's that line cross for an individual is, I think, part of it. And there's fanatics on both ends, right? Yet in the bulk of our society, I think the question, you know, if a car pulled up next to you and didn't have a steering wheel in it, what would you do? One of the, I don't remember who said it, is I'd cut him off just to see how it'd respond.
Well, that is the modification of behavior of those around the cars. But Uber's another good case in point. People were scared about the safety implications of having some random person drive them from A to B, someone they'd never met before. Mm-hmm. And until people realized, again, that's the same situation you're faced with when you get a taxi driver.
Right.
But not only that, Uber, like I mentioned before, you can work out, you know the name of the person. If anything happens, you can report that person to police, and they have quite literally a license plate of the car, and the car's being tracked as we speak. So,
right. See, that's not too big of a jump for me from a taxi to an Uber. Now, whether it's a taxi or just my neighbor has a car that doesn't have a steering wheel in it, there was at the table, it was the perception based on that it's different, and I don't understand. And we're all a bunch of reliability professionals sitting at the table. We're thinking, there's some software behind this thing, and we know there's bugs in it. Yeah. But we get on airplanes. Although I often joke that it's being a reliability professional makes it more difficult to get on an older airplane, particularly. But we still do, and it's still the safest mode of transportation around is aircraft. And that I don't think, and it's often right under autopilot, same thing as an autonomous vehicle, although it doesn't have traffic lights and stuff like that.
That's right. But the other thing too is, look, they don't have to have universal market acceptance at the start. In fact, that would be relatively useless. So if you think about once they start rolling these vehicles out, let's just say at best, these autonomous vehicles, the first generation, when people start to seriously have access to them, let's just say they account for 1% of all vehicles on the road. Mm-hmm. That figure is quite high.
That's a lot of vehicles, yeah.
That's right. I'm just using 1% to say this is an arbitrarily low figure for the point I'm about to make. I would argue that you're going to have more than 1% of the population who would be willing to jump in an autonomous vehicle. Mm-hmm. So that's all you need. And what happens with these technologies is when people start using smartphones for the first time and microwaves for the first time, and their neighbors and their family and their friends who are initially skeptical see that people are not dying and can, for example, defrost a frozen chicken within 5 minutes versus all day and realize the convenience of the microwave.
And they get you to the grocery store and back too. And you can put a microwave in these autonomous vehicles in that open dashboard.
There you go. You can actually defrost the chicken on the way to the shops and back. But
that's right. Yeah.
These guys have thought of that, and they don't need to have everyone on board straight away. They just need to have a subset of the population on board, deliver a good service to that subset of the population, and it doesn't even matter that they don't focus on spreading the word quickly. The autonomous vehicles just simply aren't going to replace the majority of cars anytime soon.
Right.
Provided the service is useful and provides utility to customers, it's going to be a reality one day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you're right. If we see and hear of enough people that said, yeah, no, that's great. Come on, let's go, let's do a test ride. Let's try it. It's same with the electric vehicles. The first time I heard even a hybrid running on just its electric motor in a parking lot, it's kind of spooky. But then you get used to it and go, oh, the world is quieter now. That's good. I don't have all these combustion engines polluting and making all this noise. So you tend to grow accustomed to it, but then expect it. There's a bunch more to that. And yet I think part of the whole thing is and listeners to this show know that it's a complex piece of technology to have an autonomous vehicle. And it's going to take a while before we ferret out all of the ways that it can fail and how does it mm-hmm. age and all of those kinds of questions. So I think there's plenty of folks still working on that and studying it and tracking it and so on. I don't think the scrutiny is a bad thing. I think that's all going to be good. Yet I agree with you. If San Francisco says, yep, bring it all in, let's do it, it may actually turn into a destination city to see what it's like to be in an autonomous vehicle. It could be a tourist attraction.
Absolutely.
That kind of stuff. So anyway, we didn't touch on it, and we'll have to come back to another episode to talk about how the way they're used. Ride-hailing companies are like taxis. They get way more mileage, and that mm-hmm. has a number of really big advantages for the reliability performance of the car. But then also, I think you mentioned, is the centralizing the maintenance, of having that ride-hailing service or a dispatch service, for example, maintaining the vehicles. If it's mm-hmm. due for an oil change, it push a button and say, come do your oil change, and it shows up. You don't have to wait on me to remember to pay attention to that light on my dashboard. That kind of problem. So we'll have to come back and talk about that one and maybe in our next episode.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when we ask our audience, would you get in an autonomous vehicle? This GM, the photo that or the image that they had with the announcement was a vehicle had no steering wheel, had no controls. It was just the typical five-seat looking car, but nobody even had an option to control it, I guess, unless you're really good at it, hacking into code with your smartphone or something, which is a whole nother issue. But we were sitting at this table, would you get in an autonomous vehicle? And
my answer was yes.
Yeah. Mine was yes. I'd have to have a helmet on and bubble wrap.
That's right.
Do autonomous vehicles have airbags?
They would have to, yes. Because they still comply with federal motor vehicle safety standards still apply. Now, for example, General Motors, when you can request an exemption, that happens when you're meeting the intent of a standard without actually doing it the way the standard says you have to. Mm-hmm. General Motors did that because there's a standard which deals with how the steering wheel needs to operate so that you can control the car.
Well, if there's no steering wheel in the cabin, then that doesn't apply, right?
That's right, yeah. Okay. And there's like ergonomic considerations of brake pedals, which again are now irrelevant, but mm-hmm. all the other things that any other vehicle has to have, which are beyond the autonomous vehicle technology, will still need to be there.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one part that we didn't touch on in this, and I was, maybe that's yet another episode, is that you in the academic world here, Chris, and and the regulators, haven't really laid out a map for this. So I think GM has just took the bull by the horns, so to speak, and said, "Well, we're just going to do it. You guys catch up later."
Well, one of the articles I wrote for Ashendo was that, you know, the industry just can't wait for academia and regulators anymore. Mm-hmm. It's embarrassing and it's sad. Unfortunately, I haven't added to the discussion at all. And I know manufacturers have been looking for that input, and it just hasn't happened.
Okay, I'll add a link to that in the show notes, but to your article, because I do remember it was nicely done. So, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm, and you can find the Speaking of Reliability episode and three or four other podcast series. Collectively, we've just crossed 500,000 downloads across these different podcasts. It's amazing. So we really, really appreciate all the support. I talked about that in the 300th episode of just how it got started and our adventure together in these shows. And we really appreciate it. And Chris, thanks so much for joining me once again. We'll have to get you on more often. And once we get a couple of responses back from our audience on whether or not we'll see, maybe I should just put a poll in the show notes. So give me this is not going to come out for a couple of days, so I got time to actually build a poll and stick it in there. So I'll do that. So we'll send it out, we'll get a poll going, and you know, what's your take? Knowing our audience is the smart, educated reliability professionals in related fields that may have a different slant on this than the rest of the population. So I'd be interested in what your take is. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Fred.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.